Welcome to the Living Waters Church Podcast.
If you have your Bibles, you can open to Mark. It's been some time since we've been in the book, so why don't we get on the same page together? Some of us might have short memories. Others of us might be new. So we want to kind of remember where we were at. So let's begin by asking the question, what is Mark? After Jesus lived, the stories about him began to spread rapidly. An oral tradition in the ancient world was how word spread and how stories got passed. But some people realized that it was going to be important to write something down. And so they did. There's four people who wrote down Jesus' story. These are called the Gospels. Gospel means simply good news. The Gospels are biographies of Jesus. They're about his life. So we have Matthew, we have Mark, we have Luke, and we have John. And, you know, these aren't probably accurate pictures of Mark, especially the top right one. He just looks like really mean in that. But I thought it was funny, so I threw it in there. The Gospels are where we go to learn about who Jesus is and how he lived. And so Mark was probably the first one to write the Jesus story down. So who is Mark? Who's this biographer? Who's this guy? Who's our author? So given what we find in the New Testament, we know that Mark's mother was like a powerhouse Christian, and so their home was a natural gathering point for the early church. We also learned that his uncle was a guy named Barnabas, who we read about in Acts. And Barnabas was of great encouragement to the church, we're told. He's very generous, and he's the Apostle Paul's advocate when he first becomes a Christian. Mark was probably bilingual and well-educated, and he may have never met Jesus, but he lived with, traveled with, and knew people very well who had lived and known Jesus. And so we know that Mark learned under Peter. And so we see lots of Peter's teachings and perspective emerging out of Acts and emerging out of Mark as well. We also know that Mark traveled and worked with Paul. And so we find elements of Paul's perspective in this gospel as well, in this biography of Jesus. So Mark spent a lot of time with people who knew Jesus personally. So what is Mark's take on Jesus? What's Mark's perspective on Jesus? What does he say about him? Well, Mark was Jewish, and Jesus was Jewish. And so this book about Jesus is from a very Jewish perspective. Mark has a very Jewish lens. And Mark believes that Jesus is not just a prophet. He's not just a teacher. He's not just a moral example or an all-around nice guy. But Jesus is actually God living amongst us. To Mark, Jesus is the same God as the God of Abraham, the God of Moses, the God of David, and the same God of the prophets that we read about in the Bible's Old Testament. So Mark believes that God, through Jesus, came to fulfill a long-term plan that God had laid out. He believed that Jesus came to serve humanity. And that this is why Jesus was wandering around performing miracles and signs. He does so in service of humanity. He does so in humility. And so Mark writes in such a way to teach the Christians of his day that following Jesus means a life of humble service towards God and towards our fellow human beings. And so these are just a couple of themes in Mark that we've been exposed to so far in the first seven chapters. If there's one thing that Mark wants us to know early on in the book, in the first seven chapters, is this. Jesus is for everybody. Jesus is for everybody. We see this emerge again, again, and again. So, I think it was Rick last year who talked about the fact that sometimes when you're watching a TV show and you can't remember what happened in the previous TV shows, they do like a kind of a catch-up thing, like a previously on. So previously in the Gospel of Mark, we've seen this happen. We're going to walk really quickly through sort of the seven chapters. So a prophet named John says somebody very important is coming along. He may not have been a cartoon. He was probably a real person. But anyway, moving on. we meet Jesus. Jesus calls 12 men to follow him and to be his students. He starts healing people. He casts out demons and he performs miracles. This stuff is only stuff that God can do, which probably means we should start asking some questions about Jesus' real identity. Jesus invites outsiders in his society to become insiders. He is kind to the poor, to the sick, and to the struggling. And so by healing people, by performing miracles, Jesus is teaching powerfully and demonstrating himself to be the God of the Israelite people. His actions, Mark shows us, are absolutely unmistakable. There's clues all throughout the journey. So, in the middle of all this, not everybody wants to accept Jesus. Some people reject Jesus. In fact, people in his hometown tell him to hit the road. Apparently, Jesus looks too ordinary, looks too humble to be God, they think. In Mark, Jesus is demonstrating who God is to humanity, and at times, Jesus acts differently than they think God should act. And so they don't believe it. God, the people think, is great, powerful, mighty. And Jesus does great, powerful, and mighty things, but he's also ordinary. He's also humble, gentle, kind, and inclusive. And so what we've seen Jesus do most recently in the last couple chapters, in 6 and 7, is we see Jesus feed 5,000 people. And in this story, is a bit of a reflection, has connections to the book of Exodus, where God provides for food of the Israelite people living in the wilderness. And Jesus provides for food in a desolate place. We see Jesus controlling the elements, and at one point walking on water, things that only God could do. We see him extend grace and love to a person in his society that many thought God must have rejected based on this person's circumstances. Jesus embraces them, loves them, has space for them. In the last part of chapter 7, we see Jesus heal a deaf man. And a little bit earlier, we see him open the eyes of a blind person. And so what this means for us is that in Jesus, we see God's face. In Jesus, we hear God's voice. And as we continue on into the rest of the book, I think that needs to be our prayer as well. So why don't we just pause here before we get into chapter 8 and pray together. Jesus, thank you for our gathering today and the chance to be together and be encouraged. And we ask as we move forward in this study that you would open our eyes to the things you want us to see and open our ears to the things you want us to hear. Help us to not just learn about you, but actually get to know you, to know your character, to be in close, intimate relationship with you. And thank you, Jesus, that you didn't just send us a letter or an email. You came to live amongst us so that we could know you. So I pray that we would do that. In your name we pray, everyone said, amen. So, Mark chapter 8, verse 1 says this. About this time, another large crowd had gathered. So as we pick up in the story, we need to remember that Jesus is not in Jewish territory. He's not with sort of his people, the people he's grown up with. He's actually in non-Jewish territory or Gentile territory, people who would be considered by his people to be unclean or dirty. And so Jesus goes off the grid. He goes off the grid. He mixes with outsiders. And we can't miss this in Mark. Jesus is intentional in doing this, because he is for everybody. The story that we read about the feeding of the 5,000 in Mark 6 has sort of similar events and things going on as the story that we're reading now. But in the story of the 5,000, Jesus is feeding the Jewish people, the Israelites. In this story, Jesus is feeding the non-Jewish people. And so this story emphasizes Mark's greater point. Jesus goes everywhere because Jesus is for everybody. Stories like this, just the fact that Jesus went somewhere different, stories like this should remind us that we should never write anybody off. But it's so easy to do that. It's so easy to think that God has rejected or abandoned or isn't interested in certain kinds of people based on how they operate or who they are or where they're from. That's because we live in a culture that has a paradigm that often helps us think in us versus them kind of ways. And that's not what we see in Jesus. You know, sometimes we think about good people or bad people, right people or wrong people, or in people or out people. But this is not what we see in this gospel. We see Jesus going to everybody. We see Jesus being inclusive. We see that Jesus isn't just for some people, and God and his grace and his love isn't just for some people. It's for all people. It's for everybody. And sometimes, you know, it's easy to sort of expect that God's grace and love is for everybody else. And the odd time, it's easy for us to feel like it isn't for us individually. You know, sometimes you talk with people and it seems like, you know, they believe that God can love everybody else, but it doesn't necessarily love them. Jesus is for everybody. God's love is for everybody, and that includes us. In Luke 15, Jesus tells three stories. The first is of a man who has 100 sheep, and one of the sheep wanders off, and so he goes to find it. He diligently searches for it. He finds it. He brings it back. He's overjoyed, and so he throws a party, invites all his friends over. The next story, Jesus says, there's a woman who had 10 coins. We go from 100 to 10. 10 coins. She loses one coin, but that coin is so valuable to her that she scours her house until she finds it. And when she does, she's overjoyed. She invites her friends over, and they have a party. And the last story that Jesus talks about is a story of a father who has two sons. And one of the sons leaves home. He says, I've had enough of this family. Give me my inheritance early. Thanks, Dad. Takes off, squanders his inheritance, ends up living with pigs, and then one day thinks, well, home's got to be better than this. So he goes all the way back home, and Jesus says the father saw him from a long way off and ran towards him, met him, embraced him, brought him back into the family, and then the father was overjoyed, and what do you think he did? Threw a party. Three stories, 100, 10, 2, all of them have one, and every character searches diligently, places high value, love, and care on the subject of the story. Jesus tells us that to know that he cares about everyone. He's interested in everyone, and that includes you, and that includes me. So if today you've never really heard that before, or you've wrestled with that reality, not nearly knowing if God actually loves you, that is the truth of the gospel. That's what the Bible teaches. That's who this Jesus is. The Jesus who searches diligently and loves each and every one of us. The story continues as Jesus has gone to and he's amongst these people. This crowd has gathered around him and he's been teaching them. And this is what we see in verse 2 and 3. And the people ran out of food again. Jesus called his disciples and told them, I feel sorry for these people. They have been here with me for 3 days, and they have nothing left to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will faint along the way, for some of them have come a long distance. I read a great article in National Geographic this past summer. I have a subscription to National Geographic, because apparently I'm an old man. Anyway, it's a great magazine. I'm ashamed to say it. So I was reading it, I think it was in August, and they had a great spread on a man named Nero, who was an emperor in the Roman world. And he was an emperor when Jesus was alive, but he was when Peter and Paul were ministering, so really shortly after Jesus. And so they were talking about sort of Nero and some of the perspectives on him and what archaeologists are discovering about him. And Nero was a bit of a megalomaniac, and so they're looking at some of the things that he built. One of the things that he built was 103-foot statue of himself in his palace courtyard. Now, to just put that in perspective, the Statue of Liberty is 111 feet tall, okay? So can you imagine that in the first century, building something that big? Now, imagine walking in next Sunday and Doug has built for himself a huge likeness, you know, not that you aren't a fine physical specimen and we wouldn't all appreciate it, but it would say a little bit about what you thought about yourself, right? Archaeologists are also discovering that at one point in Nero's rule, His palace was one-third the size of all of Rome. That his palace was one-third the size of all of Rome. And so there's actually some ancient graffiti that they've discovered. And you know, people do graffiti now. They did it in the first century back then. They scribbled on walls. And one person wrote this: "Romans, there's no more room for you in Rome. You must move to the nearby village." Right? The scholars said that Nero loved to gather the people around himself. He loved to throw big games and tournaments and stuff like that, gladiatorial exhibitions and stuff like that. But he didn't want to be amongst the people, you know, as them. He said Nero wanted to be friends with the people, but not friends as equals. He wanted to be their God amongst them. Jesus is not like Nero. Jesus isn't in it for himself. We don't see Jesus building statues of himself or giant palaces. We see that Jesus has compassion on the people. He's focused on them, not on what he can do for himself. He cares about their well-being. In chapter 6, when we see Jesus feed the 5,000 in Jewish territory, he's been teaching for one day. And, you know, it's getting towards the end of the day, and the disciples are aware that people are going to be hungry, and so they almost sort of interrupt Jesus in his teaching and say, "Oh, send the crowds away home because they need to go and get some food." And Jesus says, "Well, you feed them." They go, "Right, because we have food for 5,000 people. Pull the other one," right? And Jesus says, "Well, you feed them." And they say, "Well, we only have, you know, a couple bread and some fish." And Jesus eventually takes that on, blesses it, and works a miracle. That's the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus multiplies the food, provides for the need for these people. Mark says he looks in the crowds, he has compassion. We see a similar story here. This time the crowds have been together for 3 days hearing Jesus teach, and they've got food with them, but they've run out of food. And Mark says that Jesus is proactively aware of their need. He notices that they've run out of food. And so he sees this shortage and he has compassion on them. Have you ever thought about that much? That God looks at us in our need, or he looks at the screwed up people that need help, and he isn't sort of ticked off or frustrated, but he has compassion. This is Jesus who's revealing the heart of God to us. He has compassion. He sees our needs. He isn't frustrated by us. He wants to help. And so the inconvenience doesn't deter Jesus. The story continues in verse 4. His disciples replied, "How are we supposed to find enough food to feed them out here in the wilderness?" Jesus asked, "How much bread do you have?" "Seven loaves," they replied. So Jesus expresses his concern for the masses, but his disciples don't respond with similar sentiment. All they see is, again, inconvenience. All they see is sort of this insurmountable problem, and they look at what they have to offer, and they realize it's not much, and so they go, "What are we supposed to do about this?" The feeding of the 5,000, the previous story, doesn't seem to be very kind of forefront in their minds. We don't know when that had happened, but they've forgotten about it, apparently. Somehow, you know, it's not in their heads, and maybe they're just overwhelmed. Perhaps they're just overwhelmed by the need, by the struggle, by what is in front of them. For whatever reason, they kind of forget. Their response seems pretty familiar. We see in the book of Exodus, when we see God's people there, God provides for them again and again and again, and yet it seems like at every turn they go, "Well, how are you going to get us out of this one? How are you going to get us out of this one? What have you done for us lately?" And he goes, "I just gave you bread in the wilderness. I just parted the sea so you could be free from Pharaoh's tyranny." And again and again, they forget, forget, and forget. We see a similar theme here with the disciples. We are a forgetful people, aren't we, sometimes? Now, when the disciples are along with Jesus, they're really along for an interesting ride. And I think that if we consider ourselves followers of Jesus, we're going to be in the same boat. When God points out a need around us, or he senses that he's calling us to help someone, or to do something, or to take action, that something that takes us beyond our comfort zone. It is challenging. It can be overwhelming. It can be stretching. It can even be staggering when we think about what we might possibly be called by God to do or what he might be willing to partner with us in if we took action. Partnering with Jesus, as we see in this story, takes us out of our depth. It takes us out of the shallow end of the pool and into the deep end of the pool. But you know what? That is exciting. That's really living. That's being a part of something that we couldn't possibly fabricate for ourselves, but God working through us. Because the shallow end, in my opinion, is boring. I think the shallow end sucks. Jesus is calling us into a new place, calling us into a new way of living, a new kind of trust, a new existence, where he will do things through our lives and in our lives we couldn't possibly do by ourselves. That's what following Jesus looks like. The story continues this way in verse 6. So Jesus told all the people to sit down on the ground. Then he took the 7 loaves, thanked God for them, and broke them into pieces. He gave them to his disciples, who distributed the bread to the crowd. A few small fish were found too, so Jesus also blessed these and told the disciples to distribute them. So Jesus takes the bread and he breaks it. He gives thanks to God for it. He's probably doing this because he's in a society where many of the people gathered are polytheists. And so he's basically saying, this is the doing of the one true God of the universe, who I'm here to represent. So he does this to show them and to give thanks to the right being. And both the feedings that we see in both chapter 6 and chapter 8 sort of mirror the Exodus. But in chapter 8, this feeding of the 4,000, we have Jesus breaking the bread and not just providing for Israel, but providing for everybody, for the outsiders, for the marginalized, for everybody else. God cares about Israel. He's providing for them through Jesus. But he's expanding his kingdom to everybody else. It's easy, if we're familiar with these stories, to sort of skip through them with pace. But notice how practically generous and others-focused Jesus is. The emperor Nero used his power and authority to puff himself up and ask for praise, but Jesus uses his power and authority to practically care for and love people. And this is what genuine humility is. It's taking your power, your influence, your resources, and choosing to use those to benefit others rather than yourself, even if that means humbling yourself. And Jesus does so as he lives amongst us. Also notice in this miracle how the disciples are involved. They're not making the miracle happen. Jesus is doing that. He's doing the work, but they're in the thick of it. And so they basically become miracle distributors. The provision is put into their hands and they're just passing it around. Simply passing it around. They're a part of this. They've partnered with him in some way. They have a reason to be in the story. Jesus involves them. Mark 8, verse 8 continues in this way. They, being the crowds, ate as much as they wanted. And afterward, the disciples picked up 7 large baskets of leftover food. There were about 4,000 people in the crowd that day. And Jesus sent them home after they had eaten. Immediately after this, he got into a boat with his disciples and crossed over to the region of Dalmanutha. So the miracle happens. The food is multiplied and everyone's need is met. They are satisfied. And Mark says that 7 baskets were picked up at the end of the meal. Numbers in this passage are important, as they are throughout Mark and actually throughout the rest of the Bible. We have 4,000 people. There's 7 baskets. What do they mean? There's some symbolism there. And Rick's going to get into that for us next week. But 7, just as one example, would perhaps mean this, that 7 is a biblical number for completion. That's one of its meanings. And so with his inclusion of non-Jewish people, there is a compassion and completion in Jesus' invitation to all of humanity to come and be nourished. That's what Jesus is getting at. God will provide for everybody, not just Israel. Nobody is written off. So this past summer, I was going on vacation, and I got on a plane, and I don't go on planes a lot, but I really enjoy it when I get to go on them. And one of the things I do when I get on a plane is I pray, and I not because I'm afraid of what's going to happen, but I pray, I ask God to please make sure I'm sitting next to someone who's either really interesting or just wants to sleep. Like, I want extremes, right? So I sit down the plane, and this guy comes and sits next to me, and he introduced himself. His name's Scott, and I say I'm Luke, and you can throw that picture up there, John. And this is Scott. And I have this little trick when I'm on planes with people, because I think planes are one of those like kind of last places in our culture where we like have to interact with people. You could just read your book and phone, but it's like super awkward if you didn't talk to anybody for like 8 hours, right? So you have to talk to them some way. So as I'm talking with my friend here, I start to realize that the trick I use on planes is it's sort of awkward to lead off with the fact that you're a pastor, because you don't really know how they're going to necessarily interpret that or what their perspective of you will be. So I try and ask them as many questions as I can about them and get really deep into their life and show a lot of concern and interest so that I've established sort of a good rapport with them before I have to break the news to them that I'm a religious nut. Like, that's sort of my strategy, and so far it's worked really well. So we're having this conversation. I kind of get in depth with it. Eventually, we have seen things to be going well with Scott. And so kind of eventually he learns I'm a pastor. He's like, oh. And before that, I'm like, just promise you won't judge me. He's like, what do you do? And I'm like, well, I'm a pastor. He's like, oh, okay. So what I learn about Scott is that he's an astronomer. Okay, so he teaches astronomy at a university, and he's got his PhD. And so he teaches now, but previously he was a researcher. And he actually told me that he had discovered a number of years ago, along with a team, a brand new planetary disk. So he had actually discovered some planets in our universe that nobody else had discovered yet using telescopes. I was like, this guy's awesome. And I am like a moron when it comes to science, okay? Like, I dropped out of science in grade 11. I don't know anything about physics or astronomy or anything like that. But I was just really interested. I peppered him with questions. And because I'm a giant nerd, I had my National Geographic magazine with me on the plane. And serendipitously, the question on there was, is anybody out there? It's like, Scott, can you hold this while I take this picture? This is a great moment. And so I peppered him with questions and just asked him all kinds of stuff. And he was so gracious with me. He was so kind and shared with me all these perspectives. And I had like really stupid questions, right? Like, I don't know anything about this guy's got his PhD, and he's like looking at planets, doing math, and I can barely do long division. He's a phenomenal guy. So he's talking about like the size of the universe, and as he's talking about it probably all of his life, all the time. He's just so excited. He gets really pumped about it. He's just talking about the vastness of the universe and how huge it is. He's giving me examples of it. And I'm just amazed. I just realize how massive the universe is. And we're on this plane. I don't know about you, but when I'm on a plane and we kind of take off from the ground, I just realize how small I am. Because I see how big the world is. And it's just this one tiny part of the world I'm looking at. And then I'm talking to Scott about how massive the universe is. And we're just sitting there in awe and overwhelmed as we discuss how big everything is, how huge the universe is. We're inspired and in awe of it. I don't think Scott was a Christian, but we sort of shared that moment. Jesus, we are told by Mark, is the God who created everything. He's the God who created the entire universe. And he visited us. He lived amongst us. He talked with us. He walked with us. He healed us. He provided for us. Jesus is stronger than Nero. And he's bigger than any problem. And sometimes people will say things like, God is bigger than your problems. And I think that when they say that, they're sort of trying to encourage us to remember that, God can handle, he's big enough to deal with the situation in your life. And I appreciate that. But for me, the question is not, is God big enough to handle my problems? Because if there is a God and he created everything, then he's obviously big enough to do something about it. My question is he willing to do something about it? Is he willing to do something about it? Is he interested in me? Is he interested in my problems? Is he interested in my need? Is he willing to be involved? In Jesus, we see a God who is willing to be involved. We see a God of compassion. We see a God of love. We see a God of interest. We see that he is willing to help. I invite the band to come on back, and I think they're in the lobby chatting. So if someone could just say, hey, we need you, that'd be great. Yeah. We're going to sing a song or two as we close. And so if you are here today and you have never really had that perspective of Jesus painted for you before, and you've never really been exposed to the gospel or sort of what the Bible teaches, really encourage you as we sing this song to think about this stuff. Don't just let it wash over you, but consider the fact that maybe God, who made everything, is like this, is like Jesus, who lives with humility and compassion and kindness and is involved and wants to be involved in your life. And sort of as a church, as we're kind of moving forward and the things we talked about last week, and we think about humility and power and what we have to give as a community, I wonder if we can consider Jesus' example together as we're singing and realize that as his followers, we're expected to live like he lived. And so if we are able, if we are willing, if we have power, if we have authority, if we have something to give, if we have gifts, what are we going to choose to do with that power, that authority, with those gifts? Are we going to choose to just take care of ourselves, or are we going to be others focused? Are we going to see needs around us and ask, what can I do to help? How can I get involved? And sometimes we might look at that need and think, I don't know what I could do to help with that. Remember that if you're a follower of Jesus, you're a partner with Jesus. And he can work something through you that you couldn't work through by yourself. And so what are we going to do when we see the need around us and see what he might be calling us into? And he is going to be calling us into some newer things as a season, as a church. We talked about that last week. I think it's going to continue to happen. So I encourage you to just think about those two questions. If God looks different to you than you've previously thought, as we consider this compassionate Jesus, think about that as we sing. Maybe also think about what Jesus might be asking you to partner with him with in your life, the people that you know around you as well. Why don't we stand together as we sing these songs?